Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio War Nerd. The date today is April 24th, 2026, and this is episode 601. I am the co-host Mark Ames in the western portion of the Empire State of New York. You're listening to Radio War Nerd. Support the show. Subscribe. Go to patreon.com/RadioWarNerd and become a member. And of course, I'm online with the Warner, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher in Italy. I guess you're still up in the north part?
Yeah, we're in Torino. And we're going to head further north briefly see some friends of ours who are almost on the French border.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, the more gloomy things get in the news, the more they think, well, we can always grow potatoes up here.
Yeah. Well, Piedmont is, I don't think I never visited that area, but I had friends there and I have read and heard a lot about it. They're supposed to have great wines, great cheese. It's kind of Frenchish, right? And good meats or something.
Yeah,
is that right?
Much more French than than most of Italy. I think Italian and French are both commonly used.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Okay, well, we have a great interview with a friend of the show, Joshua Kreis, on the Sudanese Civil War, which just passed its third anniversary. So let's get right to our interview with Joshua. Okay, we are very honored to have back with us a friend of the show, returning guest Joshua Kreis. Joshua is working on a book on war in South Sudan, obviously very relevant to what we'll be talking about today. He's published articles on wars in Sudan and South Sudan in a number of publications, most recently in the New Statesman and the Boston Review, but you can also find his writings in New Left Review, Baffler, and elsewhere. And this is, well, we've had Joshua on. This is the fourth time we've had Joshua on, and it's, you know, under very grim circumstances, which is every year this war continues, we talk to Joshua about the war. And I got to say, it's a very depressing war. But first of all, Joshua, thanks for coming back on Radio Warner.
Pleasure. Wish it was under better circumstances.
Yeah. So the last time we talked, first of all, you were in Kenya, and there was you were outdoors, or it sounded like you were outdoors because the crickets or the insects, or whatever, were very loud. So it sounds like you're in a colder climate right now.
All the insects died a long time ago.
Yeah. So, also the last time we talked, so I'll ask you to kind of go over the course of the war, but in brief, when the war broke out by these two main factions that had been a pillar of Omar Bashir's regime and then kind of took control after Bashir was overthrown, this would be the Rapid Support Forces, the RSF, people have probably heard of that, and their leader Hemeti, and the Sudanese Armed Forces, led by Abdel Fattah al-Burhan. In the first sort of year and a half plus of the war, the RSF really had the initiative, controlled much of Khartoum and a lot of the, you know, centers of power in the country and of course, the east. They were moving on the East Darfur, where the RSF kind of got its beginnings. And then the last time we talked, the RSF was in retreat, especially in Khartoum. They had lost Khartoum, and the Sudanese armed forces were really kind of pushing them back. Since we've talked to you, the RSF took control over all of Darfur and committed what must be one of the worst massacres of genocide, you know, this century. I think you even said that. And now we have the war in Iran, the U.S.-Israeli war in Iran, which has direct ties, as we'll talk about, to the war in Sudan. So, Joshua, why don't you correct me there and kind of give us bring us up to speed, like where the war is at right now.
Well, so about this time last year, we were in a situation where the RSF had been pushed out of Khartoum by the army, partly by new hardware, partly by the fact that the RSF was having great problems getting troop resupply into Khartoum, the capital. And a lot of the RSF had just fled home. And the army basically had retaken all of the places in the center and along the Nile and the major agricultural breadbasket states in the center. And things were looking pretty bad for the RSF. One of the things the RSF immediately announced was that this war would not be like the other wars. Sudan has had previously two civil wars because of the existence of drones. So from March 2025 onwards, they've been using long-distance drones to strike at Khartoum, at Port Sudan, which is the administrative capital of Sudan at the moment. In the north, it's only the only real port for oil, for petrol, the main conduit into the Gulf. And what that announced basically for the RSF, that the RSF was saying, was there would be no return to normality, that there'd be no capacity in SAF-controlled territory for an everyday life that was not plagued by drone attacks and that would interrupt possibilities of trade and possibilities of export. That, of course, importantly, really annoyed Saudi Arabia. Those drones were very clearly Emirati purchased, supplied, organized, and suddenly you had basically the UAE announcing to Saudi Arabia that it would launch drones right up onto the Red Sea, right up onto the littoral with Saudi. And that was really one of the moments at which Saudi Arabia starts to come from its somewhat neutral position, trying to place itself as a mediator in this conflict towards fully backing the army. Mm-hmm. And so the division that we have in the Gulf between Saudi Arabia and the UAE over Yemen, for instance, is then fully transposed onto the situation in Sudan, such that, for instance, in the recent SAF deal to buy attack helicopters and drones from Pakistan, that's been largely financed by Saudi Arabia. So this moment also...
If you don't... I just real quickly about the drones, about the UAE drones, are these... Chinese drones, Turkish drones. Where are they getting? Are the Ukrainians helping them, or the Russians? I think the Russians are more aligned with the SAF these days, but I could be wrong. Like, where are they getting their drones and drone know-how from?
So they're almost entirely Chinese drones. Mm-hmm. The Turkish drones, including the loitering drones, are all going to SAF.
Okay.
The Chinese-built drones come through the UAE, and they are being taught. The RSF have schools, basically, in how to use the drones. One is in Uganda, just outside Entebbe. And there's also, of course, been Colombian mercenaries, the Desert Wolves group, which have been coming into Darfur and have been both operating drones and teaching the RSF how to use drones.
Are they, you know, Ukraine has had a lot of Colombian mercenaries coming in and out. Is there any link there at all? Or do we know? Or are they just their own mercenaries?
The Colombians are very much like Emirati-backed, Emirati-organized, Emirati-funded.
Right.
They have their base in Abu Dhabi and Dubai.
Okay.
So I don't know if it's the same force that is in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. I suspect one would need a Ukraine expert for that. Mm-hmm. But it is the case that Russia is active on both sides of the conflict.
Mm.
And there's a sort of, you know, as there is elsewhere in Russian policy in the Horn of Africa, a sort of breakdown between what the remnants of Wagner is doing mm-hmm. and what the Russian state is doing.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
the Russian state has come in and is very much interested in establishing a port on the Red Sea and has entered negotiations with SAF to do so because of right. the loss of bases, of course, in Syria and the question of how it gets resupply flights through to its operations in Gar, Mali, and so on. Whereas the remnants of Wagner, which almost everywhere have been displaced except in Gar, in Central African Republic, have continued to work with the RSF. So if you look at Umdafuk, right. which is one of the main gold mines in South Darfur, that has Russian security, Russian anti-aircraft installations and is moving forces, is moving gold into Central African Republic via the Russians. Right. So you have a sort of divided Russian state that corresponds to a division within like the clientelistic Russian political economy.
That's pretty wild. That's not the image one would have of Russia. But it sounds very Russian, but I'm just saying it's not the general image portrayed of, you know, an extremely tightly, vertically organized and controlled foreign policy and policy in general. Well, it also kind of a little bit reminds me of when the U.S. was, one branch of the U.S. sort of see it, was helping the SDF, the kind of the Kurdish-led forces in Syria, and another branch was funneling weapons to these Islamist, you know, Al-Qaeda link groups, and they were fighting each other. But anyways, go ahead.
So we got to about May 2025. Mm. What you saw at that moment was the UAE really doubling down on its support for the RSF for reasons that maybe we could go into later and that remain, even today, are somewhat mysterious to me. And that resulted finally in the capture of Al-Fashir. So Al-Fashir was the last of the major cities in Darfur that was not under RSF controlled. It did have some Sudanese army there, but it was really controlled by Darfuri rebel groups, largely from the Zahawa population, that saw the RSF as an existential threat to their existence, to the existence of the Zahawa people. They'd already seen what the RSF had done to other Darfuri populations, like the Masalit and El Janena at the very beginning of the war, massacres, forcible displacement of an entire population, and they worried the same thing was going to happen. And the RSF had been trying to take Al-Fashir from the very beginning of the conflict. I mean, they finished surrounding the city in the middle of 2024. They blocked aid deliveries. They constructed earthen beams all around the city. They were going to starve it out. But they couldn't quite gain aerial superiority, and they were just losing a lot of troops. Hmm. And so this was one of the cases where I think it was actually the Emirati support that turned the table. I'm sort of very suspicious of like stories of technological supremacism in Sudan's wars being like the active ingredient. I think almost always it's more a case of politics and of troop numbers and of morale, but not in this case. I think this is a very clear case where they brought in anti-aircraft equipment, Emirati anti-aircraft equipment. They brought in Colombian mercenaries to do demining operations and to run the drones, and they brought in drones. And those were the things that, you know, you were just the overwhelming reason they managed to take the city. That, of course, then they were throwing thousands of lives. They were losing thousands of people and taking Al-Fashir. But it really was those were the determining factors in the capture of Al-Fashir. All of that came in from Al-Kufra in Libya, which is a town currently run by Khalifa Haftar. Mm-hmm. So it was through the alliance of Haftar with the UAE, which created the preconditions for the capture of Al-Fashir. And you see around the whole region a series of secessionist networks in general, which the UAE has created as part of this broader regional system under its control, which is pushing for agricultural land, for Red Sea access, for ports, and for resources like gold. What happened in Al-Fashir was, of course, incredibly violent. Thousands died, 460 people died in one go at the maternity hospital where they were executed. Mm-hmm. One of the main sources of information that one has from the outside in those first few days, because there was a media blackout, a phone blackout, internet blackout and so on, is the videos recorded by the fighters themselves, which are incredibly, you know, proud and gruesome simultaneously. That after that, in Darfur, really the situation has largely remained unchanged. I'd say insofar as there's still another rebel group, largely composed of the Fur people that control the Jebel Marra Mountains, which are pretty hard to attack. Mm-hmm. But they're also in tacit alliance with the RSF in terms of that they both funnel gold to Kenya for export.
Is there an ethnic element to that too? Are the Fur... so-called Arabic or?
Well, no, I mean, so the Fur are no more Arabic than the Zahawa, but the Fur have sort of decided that the best way to survive is to not come out in open rebellion against the against the RSF. And I think that for the RSF, the fact that they are bound up in the same streams of gold, mm-hmm. Like, is enough to not want to take the Jebel Marra. Also, it's very, very hard to take and hold the Jebel Marra. It's a big mountain, or a big series of mountains, rather. So that's why there's a sort of detente there. And then otherwise, the RSF has been going around trying to wipe out various, like Darfuri Arab groups, which have been backed by SAF or represent old commanders that Hemeti used to fight. So it's a sort of mopping up operation. But otherwise, Darfur is solidly under RSF control. But that's almost a sort of misnomer to say, because I think there's a lot of international fantasies about we're going to have a division of these two, of Sudan into two countries, and one will be run by the RSF. But the RSF doesn't really run anything in the way that one would talk about as a conventional state. Like, on the ground, it's pretty socially and politically weak relative to the communities that compose it.
That would be three countries, wouldn't it, if South Sudan is involved in this? And as a side question, are they?
Well, I mean, like, I think the history of South Sudan's succession in 2011 indicates the degree to which, like, formal succession is not a solution to anything. Mm. South Sudan is absolutely part of the regional war economy inside Sudan, and those material economic flows prove far more powerful than any nominal national border. So South Sudan is involved insofar as the RSF gets petrol from northern South Sudan and western South Sudan. It ships gold through both northern and western South Sudan. There's also large-scale recruitment of South Sudanese now. And there was a big Reuters story a month ago about an RSF training base in Asosa in Ethiopia. And I was on the phone to a friend of mine, I knew a rebel in Addis, the capital of Ethiopia. And I was like, I don't know about the truth of this base. And he was like, oh, it's very true. And I was like, how do you know? And he's like, well, my two nephews were just recruited to go there under false pretenses, and they just defected. And I was like, can I talk to them? And he's like, absolutely. So I had a long conversation about this base, which is a real base. But what some of the newer commanders have been doing, who has been recruiting people in Ethiopia to fight against the regime in South Sudan, but actually, like some sort of Fagin from a Dickens story, has been funneling them to RSF bases to fight in Sudan.
Wow.
Because the money's so better?
Yeah. Or because all of the commanders, like, they get a cut from the RSF for how many men they can bring in. And those men, it should be said, are not fighting all over Sudan. They're fighting principally in Blue Nile, which is part of the south, which as at the moment is really largely controlled by SAF, apart from a small area controlled by the Esbele North, which was the darling of the international sort of Sudan Watchers crowd. It was a military organization that was secular, that wanted to fight against the evil Islamists in the north, but has now thrown their weight in with the RSF. And they don't really like having casualties. The RSF are quite fine with casualties, it seems. I mean, obviously not from the perspective of those who die. And so they've brought in a bunch of South Sudanese soldiers to fight in Blue Nile alongside the Esbele North against SAF. And that's really, there are two battlegrounds at the moment. One is the Kordofans, which is sort of dead center of Sudan, very close to the, I mean, on the road to Omdurman and Khartoum. And the other is Blue Nile in the southeast of the country. And they've become really, so you can see what the RSF's doing is trying to move through the peripheries towards the center, sort of enclose the country, including all of the South Sudanese border, in RSF control.
Can I just point out Joshua's article on this includes a really, in the New Left review, has a really good map, and it's a much more complicated map than I thought at first. It's because the Kordofan area, it's like very big difference between vertical stripes and horizontal stripes. And then you get over to the Blue Nile area and there's somebody else there entirely.
What's important about the Blue Nile area, for example? I mean, is this an important agricultural area? I mean, aside, of course, from wanting to eventually kind of pincer the capital, Khartoum, which, as you've talked about in previous episodes, I mean, it's like its own I don't know, colonizer or imperial center that has fed off the rest of Sudan. I mean, Khartoum is the prize, obviously. So, but are there important resources there?
There's a few things. There's the Roseres Dam, which is a very important source of electrification. And one of the things we've seen with RSF drone strikes is at the moment they're targeting infrastructural targets. They're making life in SAF areas as hard as possible to live. In that sense, they're rather like Israeli and American strikes in Iran. Mm-hmm. It has huge amounts of agricultural land. But most importantly, structurally, it's next to Ethiopia. So taking it allows for the supply corridor from Ethiopia that has been bringing in truck after truck, armored vehicles, soldiers, ammunition. So a lot of these RSF strikes have been about trying to establish supply corridors into the rest of the country. So that's one, I think that's probably like the most important reason is the Ethiopian border. And then it sets you up to attack into Sennar and White Nile and some of the like central provinces that the RSF tried to take at the beginning of the war, and after they lost control in 2024, there's really been a 2025. They've really been a struggle to try to take them back.
Right. And we should just point out again for people, if you're not looking at a map or haven't yet, Sudan borders several countries, and I mean this is a real regional war that interconnects with the other regional war in the Gulf. But it borders South Sudan, of course, to its south. And then sort of going clockwise, it does have a border with CAR, Central African Republic, which has been, we've talked about it in the past, there's Wagner Group or Africa Corps or whatever the Russian mercenary groups are. They've been involved there fighting against jihadist groups and really over the gold. And that's why the UAE also has a presence there. And then Chad to the west, which has been also involved in funneling weapons to the RSF. Chad borders on Darfur, so it's a natural border area. Libya kind of to the northwest. Egypt to the north, and Egypt, and I'll ask about it, is aligned with SAF, with the SAF, the Sudanese Armed Forces. And then to the east, you have Eritrea, which as far as I know is not involved in this. And then Ethiopia.
It is.
Okay. I'm curious. And then Ethiopia. And a lot of these countries have their own fractures as well and civil wars that are going on that the UAE is also exploiting. What's Eritrea's involvement in this, and who are they aligned with outside of Eritrea?
So Eritrea has been training the Darfuri group siding with SAF inside Eritrea. And also you've had Eritreans training in and with SAF in Eastern Sudan. So, which is to say that the Eritrea-Ethiopia split maps onto the SAF-RSF split. Ethiopia is the one state really backing the RSF, partly, of course, because the Emirates has supported it so strongly in its own war.
Yes.
Right, like supplying the drones that took down the Tigrayan columns marching to Addis a couple of years ago. And Eritrea has realized that in SAF, it has a useful bulwark against Ethiopia. So as the tensions between those two countries rise, so do the tensions between Sudan and Ethiopia. And I think these are the sort of dynamics that can lead to basically a broader regional war.
Yes. I mean, it's already kind of a regional war, but it could get even hotter.
Well, especially if Ethiopia really makes a play for a port on the Eritrean coast, as they seem to be making noises about.
Yeah. And Somalia, as I recall, Somalia is involved in this somehow as kind of a logistics hub through the UAE. Is that right? I think Puntland or maybe Somaliland.
Yeah. So they were running a lot of the Colombian mercenaries through Bosaçao in Puntland.
Okay.
And now Puntland has sort of thrown its arms up, and they've supposedly all been removed from there. But you have like both the UAE, Eritrea, Ethiopia, all vying for ports along the Red Sea, including in Somaliland, Puntland, and Somalia, which of course has involved like supply, like backing various secessionist movements. And I think, with the obvious exception of Ethiopia and to some degree Kenya, what the Emirates has found to be a useful modus operandi is to back minor secessionist groups that it can control more easily, and that are absolutely dependent on its patronage. And of course, they have then have a mind of their own. But who should this remind you of? Well, Iran, right? They're their most hated enemy. They've both actually sort of worked out that in an era of still like waning American power, but nonetheless a waning American power, the way to try to build up regional influence is not through like direct explicit alliances or using their military, but through proxies.
Right. So where's Egypt coming down in this? Because again, there are also these alliances that that kind of break apart over the war here. For example, Egypt is, if I'm not mistaken, is pretty close to Haftar, who is sort of the breakaway secessionist in eastern Libya. But Haftar has also been backing the RSF, and Egypt very much does not back the RSF. Egypt is backing the SAF, the Sudanese Armed Forces. So how is what's Egypt been doing, I guess, in the last year and all of this?
I mean, I think you said it beautifully. Egypt has long backed SAF. I mean, the Sudanese army is an institution which is older than the state itself, right, which comes into being in 56. And it's an institution that was created by Egypt. It was an Anglo-Egyptian colonial regime. Right. The Egyptians are directly colonizers, right? And as Egyptians always like to say, Egypt and Sudan are one. There were various schemes announced for the unity of the two countries, but very much on a colonial basis. So for Egypt, Sudan is its backyard. Sudan is also, of course, the Nile. Decisions it makes about its water have huge consequences for Egyptian agriculture. So on one level, it sees in the army its child, and when it backed the coup that displaced the transitional government that came to power after Bashir fell in October 2021, I think it imagined a sort of military dictatorship a la Sisi.
Right.
And of course, that wasn't the case, because Burhan, the head of the Sudanese army, has none of the social base or the support of al-Sisi. And so what instead he had to do was to make common cause with the Islamists,
right,
who had guaranteed Bashir's reign, the reign of this dictator, in the 1980s, in the early parts of his reign. And sort of the Egyptian army has held its nose at this. And they've hoped that they can back the parts of the army which they think of as sort of in the relatively secular tradition of the Egyptian army, and control somehow the Sudanese Islamists, to whom they are vehemently opposed.
Yes.
Because they, you know, of course, because of Morsi and the fact that the Muslim Brotherhood represent a great threat to the regime and so on. It's not clear they will be able to control them, and the Sudanese Islamists themselves, which you could talk about, have a long history, but that's their backing for SAF. But of course, at the moment, you can't think about this war as like a Cold War in which sides align on one side or another. I think you have to see a series of political interests which are deeply contoured by economic commitments. So, for instance, Egypt's principal domestic producer of wheat is an Emirati company. So the main backer of the RSF is also the people who are actually producing and have bought up Egypt's agricultural land and their domestic wheat supply.
Right.
At the same time, Egypt, in its battle with Turkey in Libya, has come down solidly to support Haftar, along with the Emirates,
right,
but in favor of the RSF, right? So you have a sort of, in a way, if Egypt came out to back the RSF, that would make more sense from that line of contemporary geopolitics, but the much older colonial history means they're on the side of SAF at the same time. And I think if you talk to intelligence officers, like, they don't see any contradiction in this. This isn't an era of clean lines. This is an era of business opportunities that can be found in the confusions of war. But I think what that means is it's much harder to come to a peace settlement, because no one sees any contradiction in pursuing war and peace at the same time.
Right. So let's talk a bit more about the Emiratis here, because we've talked about this on the show over the last sort of 3-4 months before the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran sort of really made everything a thousand times worse. But before then, the Saudis and the Emiratis went into actual hot open warfare, and the Saudis, you know, militarily drove the Yemenis and their proxies out of Yemen, and really came down on them hard and kind of organized other states in the region behind Saudis against the Emiratis. And the Emiratis looked like they were in full retreat, that they actually couldn't stand up to Saudi and the Saudi coalition's kind of power, Saudi economic power, and Saudi's just a far, far larger state. But it doesn't sound like, at least in Sudan, it doesn't sound like the Emiratis have been knocked off their, you know, their goal and their actions at all there, as far as I can tell. Has it slowed down? I mean, the Emiratis got hit so hard in the war that they're now demanding, maybe this is just because they're so pissed off, but they're going to the U.S. Treasury Department for a giant bailout, a currency swap, essentially a dollar bailout. But they're still doing their thing. They're kind of maritime imperial, you know, their empire tinkering. So has Saudi's war or attacks on the UAE changed anything at all?
Not really. I mean, I think the Emirati support to the STC was considered a red line by the Saudis, which is why they took out the Emirati ships. Yes, yes. Yeah. So the Southern Transitional Council, the Emirati-backed, sort of vaguely separatist or largely separatist Yemeni organization in the south that the Saudis considered a direct threat to their power in the country. And Yemen is their backyard and not the Emirati backyard. And that was just an absolute red line. And so they put their foot down, and the Emirates were disinclined to engage and basically did largely withdraw for the moment, including from a lot of the islands off the coast of Yemen that they've been expanding into.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But that hasn't stopped the overall Emirati plan. Mm-hmm. And I think you have to say that on every count, if there is to some degree, a war between the UAE and Saudi for, you know, control of the Gulf or the prize of best Gulf state, UAE's taken them all, insofar as it has the financial hub in Dubai. Mm-hmm. It has the center of gold resources, again, in Dubai, right? It has made itself a resource hub, a global logistics hub, a global financial hub, a global air hub in a way that Saudi has not. Of course, Saudi has all the natural advantages of population, oil supply, size, and so on. But I think, if you look at what's happening in Africa, you know, like over the last 2 years, in terms of promised investment, UAE is the biggest investor in Africa in the world. Bigger than four times bigger than China.
Wow.
That's a huge amount of money, right? And if you look at the way it is buying up ports across the world, like we're talking about 22 ports currently in development, 70 ports overall, literally controlling global logistics chains, right? All up and down the West African coast, in Latin America. You look at the way they're now buying up carbon sinks, agricultural land. This is being done with a speed and alacrity of decision-making that has left Saudi like standing in the blocks. You know, the House of Saud has none of this speed.
Looking at a map, would it not occur to the Saudi high command, if there is such a thing, that the UAE is awfully vulnerable and it's just sitting there on a few peninsulas stretching out from the Saudi coastline? I mean, is it possible that they would just take matters into their own hands and like knock the whole chessboard over?
I don't think so. But partly because the UAE is so deeply embroiled with the American Empire, right? It's the side of the
Abraham
biggest
Accords.
Military base. Well, Abraham Accords, but also just like literally materially, right? Like the deep-lying American port is in the UAE. The biggest Air Force base is in the UAE. That you would have to have America's go-ahead for this to happen. Right. And, you know, under the current regime, which is so delighted with its, you know, like future data centers in the UAE and the Abraham Accords, it's very unlikely that that would happen. I mean, one of the rumors about Yemen spread by Saudi officials, denied by Emirati officials, is that the whole reason for the imbroglio over the STC was that the Emirates were pissed that Saudi Arabia had gone to Trump to ask him to intervene in Sudan. And so took revenge by really explicitly coming out in favor of the Southern Council.
Right. You've written about this as well. I mean, first of all, and we've talked about it, the complete inaction from Washington to try to force any kind of like meaningful ceasefire, because at least up until last year, because basically the Biden administration, their priority was Israel and the Abraham Accords. And so they didn't want to lean too hard on the UAE to rein in the RSF. Then Trump comes to office and Mohammed bin Salman meets with Trump and tells him about Sudan. What happened with that? What happened with, did anything change with Trump on this?
The Trump's policy is driven by Massad Boulos, the Lebanese former used car salesman and wonderful member of the extended Trump family, who is the senior advisor for Africa, you know, and has been doing deals. And they have a roadmap. And this roadmap was sort of eked out in September 2025. So in the run-up to the attack on El Fasher, where they brought in Hemeti's younger brother, or one of Hemeti's younger brothers, Al-Ghani, though he's under U.S. sanctions, to stay in a nice hotel in D.C. As they're massacring people in El Fasher. And eventually, under the weight of the contradiction, the ceasefire breaks down. But it's still what's on the table. And what's on the table is a three-month humanitarian truce, then a permanent ceasefire, and then a nine-month transition to civilian-led government. And that's been offered by, in theory, the Quad, which is this name for the US, Saudi Arabia, UAE, and Egypt, those being the four powers that count relative to Sudan. And for all sides, this doesn't make, like, this is a non-starter. For the RSF, it's a non-starter because all of these schemes basically envision that the RSF is sent to cantonment sites, sent to sort of, you know, training sites, absorbed into the army and then made to disappear. And of course, like having just, you know, raped and raised and killed your way through Sudan, not only does that like make no sense in terms of your power structure, it opens you directly to retaliation and recrimination. Right. The SAF, the Sudanese army, has absolutely no interest in any deal that allows the RSF to have more legitimacy. Like Egypt and Saudi are both saying like the only legitimate institution in the country is the army. The army needs to stay there for some time. Any sort of like civilian transition can't come until there's been, you know, a long period of disarmament from the RSF. They don't like, basically they don't accept, and neither does SAF, the placing of SAF and the RSF on an equal footing. They think of as the RSF as a rogue militia and SAF as the army, though of course the army has been just as predatory and violent as the RSF in many places of in Sudan. And so you're stuck with this standoff, basically, where like there's nothing in it for either side to want to come to the table. And I think especially now SAF looks, there was a recent decision by the US government to put the Sudanese Muslim Brotherhood as an agent of terrorism and put them under sanctions. And while that doesn't like affect like actually constitutive members of the SAF, of the Sudanese Army Coalition, it does affect, because they're not Muslim Brotherhood, they're not members of the Muslim Brotherhood, but they are members of the Islamic Forces and Ali Karti, or they are members of various like Islamist brigades.
Islamist brigades that are under the command of the SAF?
Yes, well,
or aligned with, I guess, in theory,
they're aligned with the SAF. Okay. I mean, they're actually like one of the things about the SAF that's been true from its inception, sorry, Egypt, is they're terrible at fighting. They've never been good. Yeah. You know, like they fought two civil wars, but the reality was those civil wars were largely fought by outsourced militias, not by the army itself. And that's true of this war. If you look at like who's active in the Kordofans, it's militias that they bribe to move away from the RSF. So they're deploying the RSF against the RSF.
Right.
If you look at who's fighting in Blue Nile, it's troops under Malek Agar, who used to be a member of the Esplanade North, the force fighting with the RSF.
Mm-hmm.
So like to talk about it as the Sudanese army really does the army too much of a compliment. Right. It's militias plus air power on both sides.
It sounds to me like, without necessarily taking a side, because it's very hard to... The RSF is committed, it seems like, the most overtly... They're kind of incentivized to the most overtly egregious war crimes. But it's not like the SAF are necessarily the good guys here. But it does sound like, and correct me if I'm wrong, if you took the UAE out of this equation, if the UAE was, you know, signed a deal or was forced to agree to no longer provide any support to the RSF, that the war would possibly end. Wars never end exactly when you think they would, but that would do more to bring the war to an end than anything, and not in RSF's favor, of course. Is that true, or is there any other lever like that?
No, that's right. I mean, I think the truth is, if America wanted this war to end tomorrow, it could do it, basically. And of course, that would leave, like, you know, lots of residual tensions in Darfur that would have to be worked through local peace agreements that would, you know, leave scars for decades. The depth of devastation is incredible. But fundamentally, the RSF is a militia that has always been parasitic on state support. Originally, it was parasitic on support from Khartoum, and now it's parasitic on support from Abu Dhabi. Cut off that support, and it simply could not sustain a war against SAF, backed by Egypt, backed by Qatar, backed by Turkey, backed by Iran, you know, name the power. And ultimately, the US does have it in its power to tell the RSF, to tell the UAE to stop funding the RSF. It just doesn't want to.
Right.
Like, ultimately, the geopolitical priority of keeping the UAE on side with Israel is just more valuable to them than ending the war in Sudan. Like, killing Gazans is just more important than saving Sudanese.
Right.
And that's like reductive and brutal, but that is just the truth of how the geopolitics of this war would work.
So since the Iran war started, you're saying it hasn't really affected the Sudan war in any particularly meaningful way.
Well, to some degree, it's interrupted the export of oil insofar as it's been interference on the Red Sea from Port Sudan. Right. Iran has had been a backer of SAF.
Mm-hmm.
Along with Egypt. So you see the strange regional contradictions that are involved in supporting this war. But it hasn't fundamentally changed things. I think just simply because the possibility of like the UAE and Saudi Arabia again finding common cause against Iran at the same time as they're fighting it out in Sudan is this sort of much more fragmented conflict that I think you're seeing around the area. Of course, then, the Sudanese farmers who are already suffering, I mean, like, the depth of humanitarian crisis in Sudan can't be understated. And the fact that fertilizer routes are now being blocked and fuel market is being blocked, as well as, like, crucial strategic goods, is going to aggravate, especially, like, Sudanese army-held territory, right? And the possibility of farming in a place like Blue Nile, which requires commercially produced fertilizer that they're not getting.
Right. I was reading on a United Nations page about millions of desperate Sudanese return home amid dire conditions as war rages. So there are internally displaced Sudanese that are returning to either the capital Khartoum or Al Jazeera State. That's the name of one of Sudanese states. What are the conditions that are allowing them to return, and is that making life for them any better?
So people are returning not just internally, but also externally. There's been such a violent crackdown on Sudanese refugees in Egypt. Conditions have been growing more difficult, especially under the cuts to UNHCR and other UN bodies and NGOs following Trump's cutoff of US aid and like follow it and cutoffs in other global north countries that mirrored that. So people have been going back to Omdurman, not so much Khartoum and Buri, but like the north of the tri-state area around Khartoum, also to Al Jazeera, which was, and people are going back, one, because conditions are at least relatively stable for now, but two, because that's where home is, and people are going back to their old buildings and trying to reconstruct life. And at least, you know, I have friends who moved back to Omdurman because at least there, like, even though there's, you know, limited water and the electricity basically doesn't work, there's, you're doing something, and you're not just living a suspended life waiting for something to begin again, which is all too often the fate if you remain as a refugee in a country without the possibility really of working or of building a life.
Yeah. What's happening in the South Sudanese civil war right now? I mean, or how much of a civil war is it?
Oh, it's a real civil war right now.
So it's full bore right now. Okay. Yeah.
Well, it's full bore in the way that South Sudan can be full bore.
Right.
So you have, you know, a government which is using Israeli, Ugandan companies to launch airstrikes. You have attack helicopters burning down areas from the Nuer, South Sudan's second largest ethnic group. But the problem in South Sudan, and you could say much like in Sudan, is that the army has very little social base. It is unpaid. It is demoralized. And so the government is fighting via militias, which intensify ethnic conflict because they're often monoethnic militias. And they're facing populations which deeply see the government as lacking any legitimacy. So the army keeps losing. They keep taking territory and then withdrawing. But the thing about the opposition is it's doubly hamstrung. One is that there's no external support for it. No one wants to come in and back these militias. And the other is that they're deeply ethnically internally divided. These two points are not obviously unrelated. And so they end up sort of fighting a war for control of ammunition that will allow them to continue to fight the war. And that becomes like just the reoccurring cycle while the government flails around for external support. At the moment, the Russians have just opened an embassy in Juba and they are going all in on support for Salva Kiir. They're going to try to back some fake elections for December this year, which will sort of coronate the regime of the South Sudanese president. And they're talking about taking over the oil stakes from a Malaysian company called Petronas that pulled out last year because the South Sudanese government has been so bad at paying oil companies.
Mm. I thought the Chinese were in the oil industry in South Sudan. Or is
they
that
are.
Just,
yeah.
They are, okay.
Yeah, so they have there. The majority stake. They are, okay. They're still there. I mean, the Chinese say that their place there is deeply political. They're not making money out of the oil. What they're doing is guaranteeing their interests for a time when South Sudan becomes stable. And they might be willing to count that time in decades.
You know, from one of your articles, I just wanted to read something here. Mm. This is from your article Inside Sudan's Perpetual War about the videos that you were earlier talking about that came out of El Fasher. Much of what we do know has been gleaned from videos recorded by smiling RSF fighters. In one video, the RSF stalked through the Saudi maternity hospital shooting patients. In another, one RSF officer, Al-Fateh Abdul Idris, known as Abu Lulu, is perched in front of an emaciated prisoner, lying prone on the ground, his legs blown off. The cameraman pans right to a heap of bodies lying on the banks of an earthen berm with dozens of smoldering vehicles just beyond them. Abu Lulu then engages the prisoner in conversation, and as he begs for his life, other fighters strip the possessions from corpses. Abu Lulu then shoots the prisoner before striding off in search of another victim. In another video, he tells a captive, quote, "I will never have mercy. Our job is only killing," unquote. And I just couldn't help of thinking of Hexeth's macho, press conferences where he's talking about, you know, gloves off. We're not going to hold back like the previous wokesters did. No mercy, no quarter. I mean, to me, this is what it is. I don't know. People have some idea of what no mercy, no quarter, and this kind of macho Hexethian talk is. I don't know, a Marvel, something from a movie or something, but this is what it actually is in practice. I just wanted to mention that. It just stood out, and this whole thing just really depresses the hell out of me. Onto something, I don't know, maybe this isn't more hopeful, but you have written about, and we have talked about in the past, like this isn't, this war, among other things, the war that broke out in 2023, initially just between these two kind of junta pillars, the SAF and the RSF, what really put the final stake in what was a very hopeful period, a brief hopeful period in Sudan, and particularly Khartoum, between the overthrow of Bashir and then the outbreak of this war, when there was a lot of genuine grassroots politics going on. That's done now, but can you tell us about where, you know, maybe just remind listeners a little bit about what was briefly, you know, a kind of a Khartoum spring or something, what was hopeful and possible and where any of that is right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to remember that this is a counter-revolutionary war.
Right.
That these two actors unify to depose a transitional government, and they effectively, what the war did was displace a weak junta government, and that junta was arranged against the population, and instead make the primary opposition in the country one between two armed parties, which eclipses the civilians.
Right.
And who are those civilians? Well, you know, from 2013, you have a recurrent mobilization of Sudanese people, both against the iniquities of the economic policy of the previous regime, Bashir's regime, but also for various types of democracy. And one of the forms that really emerged in 2013 during protests was the Resistance Committee. And the Resistance Committee was the sort of popular negative, Majdi Al-Ghazouli would say, of the Popular Committee, which were Bashir's sort of local committees that monitored morality and what your neighbor did and who you did and who got to build a sports field and who didn't, and were sort of, the resistance committees were non-hierarchical, they were organized around mutual aid, they were organized in a very inclusive way, so you had the possibility of various forms of, like broad societal inclusion. Of course, their character differed depending on where they were from a poor area like Kalakla, they'd be very different than from El Riad and the sort of the bourgeois who almost turned them into an NGO. But these were the forces across the country, and especially in the periphery, that brought down Bashir, that created such conditions on the street in 2018, going in 2019, that by April, forced the military to bring down Bashir. So what happened to those forces during this war? Well, some of them turned into emergency rooms and have been bravely organizing healthcare and food distribution across the country. They've been arrested by both sides. They've been beaten by both sides. Some of the resistance committees have decided that the only way to save the country from the RSF is to join with SAF, and they formed their own militias. I think there's a broad swathe of what has happened. I think what's sort of interesting about the emergency rooms is that as the state collapsed and the international humanitarian left the country, fled the country at the beginning of the war, the emergency rooms coalesced into something like a vision of a sort of anarchist non-state state all around the country providing services. I think, you know, skeptics of the movement would just simply say, yes, but that isn't the state. And they don't have the capacity to provide services all across the country. And I think that's true. I also think that at this stage, one would have to be very optimistic and almost reactionary to think that the Sudanese state is going to be put back together in the same way.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's no state as it is.
Right. Like the prior two civil wars were basically a center fighting against the periphery. And they ended because the periphery was absorbed to some degree in the center. The center's promises proved to be false, and then war restarted. That's not going to happen this time. There isn't a periphery in the same way, and there isn't a center. We've seen like the Khartoum, a national capital, has been razed. The only time in, you know, in the 21st century this has happened. It's not going to be put back together like that. And I think one of the things that we've seen is that what you have in Sudan, like elsewhere increasingly, is a combination of external sub-imperial powers, like the United Arab Emirates and Saudi, backing regional militia or secessionist forces. So the level of the state itself is bypassed.
Yeah.
You have external power and you have internal fragmentation. And, you know, if I wanted to, like, try to find an optimistic lining there, I'd say what that allows is a real sense of federalism.
Mm-hmm.
Like, any political solution, I think, inside Sudan has to be honest about the reality of those fractures and the way that they cleave onto already existing real deep senses of identitarian difference within the country. And what that would mean would be taking seriously the forces on the ground and not so much trying to feed into the fiction of a new return state. I think if you look at the situation in Somalia, where, you know, since the fall of the Islamic Courts Union, what, 20 years ago, thanks to the American-backed Ethiopian invasion, look, the internationals have just spent billions propping up a state because they like the CIA interrogation centers they have in Mogadishu. But that's not a mean, that's not a way to, like, get an actual country.
Yeah.
Right? Like, in a sort of paradoxical way, the very insistence on a state system is what's preventing in Somalia and now I think in Sudan the possibility of a real country.
And on the flip side of this, this war, I mean, the sense I get from, you know, talking with you, but also in reading your articles, you know, early on, there was this sense of there was something so artificial about the war because it was just these two, you know, military pillars of a junta fighting for control. But it definitely became an organic, I guess you'd call it, but, you know, a full-scale kind of fractured civil war since then. And I get the sense that this war could go on for many, many more years to one degree or another, for decades maybe, or certainly more years. Do you get that sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the last two civil wars both lasted 20 years, more or less, right? And they were wars where you had sufficient, in the second case at least, international interest in bringing the war to a close amid like the last fever dreams of 1990s end of history triumphalism, which, you know, was going to produce South Sudan as an independent nation. I don't see that sort of regional compact existing.
Right.
In fact, I think the fact that, you know, both Saudi and the UAE think they have carte blanche to support who they want in this war means that, you know, forces that otherwise might come to the table aren't really very interested in doing so.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's hard for me to even see under what conditions peace would happen. And to be honest, while a real ceasefire would of course be good, and, you know, the allowing of unrestricted humanitarian aid would of course be good, I don't know if these are real prospects. I think they're very easily instrumentalized prospects. And I think the danger is what you slide into is basically a continual war economy, even under the name of peace, because what that peace guarantees is the continual SAF domination of this country.
Yeah.
And it's very hard right now to see a way out that doesn't walk through Port Sudan and through SAF domination. But given that that's at the moment a red card for the RSF and for the Emirates, it's hard to see a way out of this war at all.
But it sounds like, from what you're saying, that if you had to choose between the two forces, at least the people who are involved in the resistance committees and you know, self-organizing kind of politics, that if they had to align with either of them, they seem to be aligning more with the SAF. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I remember reading a few firsthand accounts of I think one was called The Interpreter or something. And he seemed to be portraying the RSF as sort of barons in have sword, will hire kind of way, who had no particular loyalty to the southwestern part of Sudan, but lost the battle for Khartoum and had to set up there. So, I mean, do they have like an ethnic base or a source of soldiers?
Yeah, I mean, I think that one has to bear in mind that the high command around Hemeti is not what constitutes the RSF's fighting forces. And they're deeply beholden to the way that they've been organized, which is to say that since the beginning of the war, they've basically recruited from among Darfuri Arab groups. And the rhetorical claim there is that the Darfuri Arab groups are facing a rhetorical struggle against the non-Darfuri, against the non-Arab Darfuris. And that's why they need to mobilize. And they've mobilized rather than by paying wages than by paying the heads of different Darfuri Arab sections and giving them weapons. But they're largely acting in their own interests. So, you know, like a lot of the Salamat and the Beni Halber, when after Al-Fashir fell, they just went home with whatever loot that they took, right? So it's not like they're in command of some hierarchical army. They're in command of forces that often have local goals that are at odds with the RSF's war machine's aims. So I think a lot of the reason that the beginning of the war in El Geneina, the fighting was so violent and the pogrom effectively against the Maslit occurred, was that for the Arab groups that did that, this was unfinished business with the Maslit. This wasn't particularly in the interests of Hemeti, who was now branded as a war criminal and a genocidaire. So it's not that they have a very deep Arab base inside Darfur. Elsewhere, the pattern of recruitment has shifted. So if you look at the Kordofans, they've basically been a sort of, you know, like Thatcherite version of SAF. What they've said in West Kordofan, two militia leaders from those communities, from the Rezagat, from the Misriya, is, look, we are just going to tax you less. Keep on going with your checkpoints, with your control of business, and we will sit on top of you, we'll give you weapons, and we'll give you less taxes for controlling your own areas than the SAF. So it's, you know, like, it's wrong to see them as like a strong force in many ways. They're really deeply dependent, not just on external support from the UAE, but on the intensification of forms of communitarian militarization. And I think like what leads to the fracturing of the conflict is that communitarian militarization leaves a much more lasting legacy than the RSF in some way.
Right.
Right. And you see that like commanders are now defecting to SAF. That these commanders aren't sort of in the pay of the RSF because they believe in the RSF project. This is a temporary, that they're temporarily with them for a moment because that suits their interest, but there's no reason that they would stay with them.
Right. If they get a better deal from the other side, they'll switch over. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So the Sudan is just going to be very hard to put back together. I mean, if this war has succeeded in doing one thing, not permanently, but it's definitely, it really has driven a stake in the heart of that sort of democratic uprising and sensibility that grew up in the 2010s. It's just so deeply gutted the country that even if you were to stop it tomorrow, it's going to take a long time to piece it together, it sounds like.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that's depressing. So what do you see going forward? I mean, you know, each year when we would talk with you, Joshua, we were kind of thinking, okay, we've maybe hopefully kind of come to the, you know, to the point where this should be settled. I mean, by last year, I guess less so. But now looking forward, well, I guess maybe we already answered it. Looking forward, it doesn't look like anything is going to be settled anytime soon.
No, I mean, I think it's likely that the RSF will take much of Blue Nile in, you know, as we come like out of the rainy season, or as we come into the rainy season, things will stop. So the next like 3-4 months, other than drone attacks, I guess ultimately you have to think that the RSF will take much of the Kordofan's if not all the Kurdo fans, despite the US Army continually trying to reopen roads to some of its like embedded forces in North Kordofan. But just like the weight of the population has thrown the population has thrown its weight behind the RSF. In like much of South Kordofan, much of North Kordofan, it's hard to see them not taking those areas. I think further north of that becomes very problematic because it just becomes a red line for the Egyptians. And I think the RSF are very cognizant of where they can't go, where that would really trigger response from the Egyptians as like going beyond the red line for them. So I think there will be something like a de facto partition of the country. And it's one in which, you know, both sides in some sense domestically profit. They profit from, as I said last year, the export of livestock from Darfur, from the miserable pastoralists of Darfur through Port Sudan. They profit from gold, right? Let's not forget that UAE is also the site, not just for the gold that the RSF has a role in mining in Darfur, but also the larger mines in North Sudan under SAF control. The entire banking system that SAF runs is in Dubai. So it's also under Emirati control. You know, like they're really deeply imbricated into this war economy. And it's hard to see that breaking down, right? And I think the sort of the regional tensions, even provoked by Iran, make that hard to, which is to say that, you know, a lot of the Sudanese Islamists came out in support of Iran after the US strikes. And Burhan was immediately very quick to sort of go, no, these guys are not representative of my government. But, you know, everyone is very, like, Burhan just appointed Yasser Abdulrahman Hassan al-Atta. And al-Atta is the chief of staff. Al-Atta is like a really hardline military figure. I don't think anyone is interested really at the moment in a push towards a peace agreement. They're basically, there's a refusal to negotiate. And I think America, like some sort of, you know, bull in a china shop, is just doing things that have sort of basically uncalculable consequences. So at the moment, it's talking about lifting sanctions against Eritrea.
Right.
And bringing Eritrea
into
it's connected to the UAE.
Okay.
Right? So it's like this, maybe the UAE wants Eritrean ports.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, like we're living in a time where geopolitical strategies are thought up by a child whose name is Jared.
Right.
You know, but that have real consequences in the world, and like and kind of unculturable consequences.
Yeah,
because it's not like a proper SAF Eritrean link. Maybe then with Saudi, because they have to shift from UAE. What would the UAE then do in Ethiopia? Like, it's very unclear to me how a lot of these things play out, other than like deep discordance and chaos.
Yes. I think on that grim note, I think we can end this discussion. It's been very helpful. I mean, it's frustrating. I don't know if it's frustrating for you writing on it. Your articles have been great. I mean, very well written. It's very complicated, as people can hear. Very complicated and very frustrating because nothing breaks down neatly whatsoever. And it's sort of like the harder you look at it, the less solvable it seems. I mean, the magic bullet, which would be knocking out the UAE, like that's just not going to happen. So if it's taken as much damage as it has from its spat with Saudi Arabia, and then, you know, getting knocked around by Iran and stuff, like it hasn't. That's just not going to happen. So I really appreciate you talking to us and, you know, keeping us up to date on the war and explaining, like I said, a very just complicated and very frustrating situation. Does this seem frustrating to you as well in that way, or you're deeply enough into it that it makes more sense to you?
No, I mean, frustrating, tragic.
Yes.
You know, yes. Deeply sad. I mean, it's the loss of many of my friends' lives, but it's also the loss of their homes and worlds. And it's not clear what the Sudan is for those who fled that one would return to, right? And I think that doesn't have a simple, clear answer.
I mean, the no. Khartoum that you described, in the pre-war Khartoum, they're really great, uplifting articles when you were writing about, you know, that brief kind of spring period of self-organizing and grassroots democracy. I mean, it's very hopeful and very well described. And so, you know, it's not like Sudan is inherently all misery like this. There is a better possibility, but that ain't it right now. So anyway, thank you so much to Joshua Kreiz for coming back on the show and telling us about where we are at the fourth year anniversary of the Sudanese Civil War. Yes, we're into the fourth year. That's right.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you so much, Joshua.
No worries. Pleasure being here.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, that was Joshua Kreiz on the Sudanese Civil War. Thanks again to our guest, Joshua. Thanks, John, Brendan, and all of our supporters of the show. Talk to you soon.
Thanks,
bye.
Everybody. Bye.